This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents You're on an Airplane, a self-mythologizing memoir. This is the author, Parker Posey. Part 1. You're on an airplane. Hi. I have the window seat. How very kind. Thank you. Chivalry is not dead, but I'll just squeeze by. Oh, that's okay. I'll just smush them both under the seat. And once we're in the air, I'll take one out and use it as an ottoman. I sit cross-legged so Gracie can be in my lap once we're off, but thank you. She is, actually. My boyfriend at the time, Ryan, his grandmother had just died, and they'd watched the Burns and Allen show together when he was a kid. I wanted a name that could evoke equality because I knew I'd be repeating it. I didn't want to name her Snickers or something. Something, come here. I sat next to a dog and its owner at the Union Square dog run once, and the dog had on a collar that spelled Bow Wow in separated silver lettering that slid and turned. And the bow part was under the dog's neck. I said to the owner, I can't believe you named your dog Mom. And he was like, it spells Bow Wow. I told him that I was joking, and then it got awkward because he seemed to be sad or depressed. These are strange times. Maybe naming your dog Mom isn't so odd. It seems like everyone is feeling lonely in some way. Left out. I'm working on a book, actually. It's about me. It's okay, Gracie. She's on a doggy downer. She'll be okay once the plane takes off and the slamming doors stop. They bang no matter how you close them, like they were made to slam. Yeah, I like those movies too. Best in Show's a classic. You'll hear more about it. Yes, she's an emotional support dog, so she can be in my lap. I have the papers in the seat flap in front of me, if you need me to reach down there to get them. Seltzer with ice, please. No, I'm good. No lime. Don't bother. It used to be so different, flying. Yes, a book. I realized it was time. There were stories to share that my friends were entertained by, so I thought, you know, tell them. There's also a literary agent who lives in my neighborhood, whose partner art directed Party Girl. I started feeling guilty when I'd see him because he'd say, I know there's a book in you. So I went into a sort of labor and produced a sort of baby where instead of being human, it's a bound object made of paper called pages with words on it. You bring it to life and make it talk. Just don't leave it alone for too long because it will start crying. Can you hear Gracie snoring? Her little body vibrates when she does. I use my southern accent when I talk to Gracie because she's just too sweet. Being number one in the tarmac is so winning. It's such an honor, so thrilling. I got interested in acting because I was born into it, born into turbulence. It's kind of simple. I'm a character actor because I come from a family of characters. When people ask if anyone in my family is an actor, I say all of them. They're performative people. They'll star somewhat in this, in the way mother and father star in our lives constantly, as constant as a northern star. But I'll take the lead. When my dad and I fought, he sent me to my room to write him a letter. He wasn't good at expressing his feelings when he was angry. He was better at letter writing. And since he was an adult and I was just a child, he won. He was passionate and knew how to pull heartstrings. We joke in our family that he was the puppeteer, and he'd splay his hand wide, moving it slowly from side to side, controlling the strings. We'll be in the air soon, and closer to the real stars, which make the constellations, which branched the first stories from the heavens. My book is called You're on an Airplane. It's a memoir, pronounced with the emphasis on me. Flying can be nice once you're in the air. Don't you wish we could be here forever and never have to land? One, to perform. Flight attendant. Hi. Can I have a scotch, neat? Norma Desmond, the fading silent film star, who bemoaned the advent of talkies, was portrayed by the inimitable Gloria Swanson, first clothes horse and woman of indomitable spirit. You've seen it? So you know that she wore a turban in the film and said things like, "I am big, it's the pictures that got small." Now look how small the pictures have gotten on these freaking iPhone screens. The tiny screens have gotten into people's hands, and there's all this swiping going on, all this shoo-fly bullshit. In the 90s, we had big screens in the cinema and big TVs in our homes. It boggles the mind that people can walk around with small televisions in their pockets and use them as telephones. I saw a baby in a stroller on an iPhone just the other day on the sidewalks of Manhattan. Now tell me, who is that baby texting? Are you on Facebook? It's wonderful that people have their Facebook friends, but I don't have Facebook friends because I'm not on it. I want to read people's faces in present time reality. And how could they be a book? It's presumptuous and absurd. I went on someone's Facebook once. Now that just sounds crude. And what I really wanted was proof that these are real people. But there is no proof because I wasn't there. I wasn't on the vacation, at the graduation, at the spring break party. I wasn't there for the birth of the baby or for all those salads. It should be called Scrapbook Face. That's more apropos. There was a movie made about that guy who invented it. Mark Zuckerberg, right, thank you. I never saw it, but I did go to the premiere to mingle in the lobby of the theater and to social network. Anyway, my Instagram followers say not to join because it's a rabbit hole, and I trust them. Is this how I grow old? Saying things like, my followers, like a cult leader. And going on about turbans. Looks like it. Headwear feels right, especially after you reach your mid-40s and start seeing the older person you'll become. Would you like a brush? Eye drops? Oh my God, that feels good. Care to slather your face with moisturizer? You have pretty hair, young lady. Don't fall asleep, I want you to listen. Turbans apply to the men out there as well. Who will become older ladies as they soften with age. It's kind of fun getting older and giving advice, calling young people dear, and talking to myself in public, not caring who hears me, uttering sentences that come out as extraneous sounds and feeling no need to explain myself in words because a facial expression will do. It's perimenopausal time, which to me sounds like an adorable puppet troupe. Maybe not. Here, let me put a turban on you. I travel with scarves, wraps, and throws. Press your finger on the fabric at the top of your forehead, where your hairline starts. And hold. I'll wrap you up. It feels good to have something on your head that makes you feel like a witch or a genie, doesn't it? Let's get some magic back. Do you have a lover? You don't have to tell me if you do or don't, but if you do, they'll dig this. After you get out of the bath together, make breakfast like dry toast with a poached egg and a side of cantaloupe. Come here so I can look you in the eyes. You'll hear. We're all multidimensional beings, babe, because everyone is a time traveler, if only for a moment. And then maybe, are you upset about something? Do you need any help with anything? Who knows what will happen after that? One thing's for certain. Your hair will dry, and you'll go to work, where you can get wrapped up again, caught up in the picture of the vacation you weren't invited to join, and maybe you'll text that little baby back. You can shoo-fly your phone till the cows come home. Don't you feel better now that you know your head won't fly off your body? Give me a headdress and a magic carpet, please. Why this diminishing of the feminine? Why is it still happening? I know it's been like this for a long while now, since we stopped worshiping the sun and the moon. But it feels like we should be beyond that. Sun and moon, good and evil, blah, blah, blah. It's all one. Will you press right here? Right between my thumb and forefinger? Yes, that's where my headache is. Did you know that the Hollywood system of storytelling quadruples for men as they age? I read that somewhere. I guess it's because the men are rarely home in those movies because the women don't want machine guns or aliens in the house. I must have dozed off when you were pressing my hand like that. I had a dream. I was running a marathon and staying in Matt Damon's home in the wilderness. He lived there whenever there was a marathon. No, wait, I wasn't running. I was on the side of the road walking to Matt Damon's. We shared some eroticism, and I noticed glitter all over his bedsheets. He said he'd gotten divorced, and I wondered why, because I'd heard his wife was so lovely. Then I saw a little movie, like a commercial in my mind. Strange Christmas decorations appeared and dissolved. An icicle plaque with the Damons written on it. And then a fire poker with children's names on it. Dinner was being served, and the clang of silverware turned to Christmas. I don't like Christmas. It's too much of a production. I've already done too many. I do love Jesus, though. I'll have the chicken a la king. I was staying in Hollywood, at Chris Kattan's house, and I was crying. This was not a dream. This was real. Chris is like a brother to me. I was sitting outside on the stone steps Danny DeVito brought back from Big Sur or somewhere. Danny and Rhea Perlman owned the house before Chris bought it. Rhea had her dance studio in the bedroom where I slept. Anyway, I was on the phone with my manager at the time, and I was freaking out that I didn't have a job. To encourage me, he said, "Look at Jeremy Renner, who he also represented. He didn't start getting work until his 40s. And I said, "I know, but he's a man. I'm not a man." There was a lull in the conversation because I had a real point. I could hear my manager sense that I'd become too aware to be handled and coerced into delusion. Actors actually pay their agents and managers not only to negotiate contracts, but also to encourage fantasies and help conjure them, which is what I think delusion is. It's why I still love every agent I've ever had. Look how cozy that salad is in its little bowl. Well, my manager knew I wasn't having it anymore and that I'd had it. It's possible that somewhere in there I'd remembered not being available to meet for one of those early action films with Matt Damon. It could have been the beginning of the Bourne Identity. I simply wasn't prepared to be scared in a car for a few months, even with Matt Damon. There was an Anaconda movie, too, that I turned down because I didn't want to wrestle with snakes or be in wet clothes while at work. Whenever I get to the point of exasperation, I like to say, "I feel like my head has flown off my body," or "Where's the man who would want to put his hands on my head?" I will say that Jeremy Renner is a wonderful hugger because we were at Sundance and he gave me a really nice hug. I didn't get to the point of having him place his hands on my head, but I'm almost certain he would have if I'd asked. I've maintained a career and I love to act, but I think every job is my last. And when I start the job, I forget that I know how to do it, and by the time I find out that I do, I'm done. I'm always thinking of other jobs I could do instead, but maybe those are just characters I want to play. I'm not great at being a movie star. It's either too boring or too much work. I've had too much therapy, I think. My career took shape, organically, farm to table, when the culture supported independent films, and I didn't have to feel like a movie star if I didn't want to. The independent film world, in the early 90s, had a real independence from the Hollywood system, much like in the 70s. It reminded me of my early silent film work with auteurs like Cecil B. DeMille. And then Time called me the queen of independent cinema, and that's when my career in independent cinema virtually ended. Oh my God, this cough. I don't like games. I wasn't, and I'm still not good at them. They make me uncomfortable, even board games, and especially charades. I do like puzzles, and an intimate in-house karaoke party. Singing is not a game. I do love The Voice. I make a really good cup of coffee. Life is good. When I was a little girl, my dad would recite Emily Dickinson's I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Are You Nobody Too? Then there's a pair of us, don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. He's an entertainer and fighter by nature, a star in his own life. My mother comes to life through the lens of my father, but holds her own naturally. I obviously came to life from my mother. They were movie stars in my eyes, fabulous Southern characters. So my own character, what could be a fragmentation of selves, finds a wholeness in performing many different parts, and finds recognition in others of similar makeup. The arts and show business are full of these people. I had a movie mother in the late, great Nora Ephron. She sent me an email a few months before she left the planet that I've memorized and kept close to my heart. Dear Parker, I love watching your life from the middle distance. No one has a career like yours. And although I understand it makes for moments that have to feel less than secure, it also means you have so many things you would never have done if your life were more conventional. Love, your mother. She'd tell me there wasn't a conventional bone in my body. A couple of years back, I wasn't sure I could handle how financially motivated and conventional showbiz had become, even in the theater, which was surprising and devastating. I originated a role to a great review in the New York Times, thank you, only to be replaced with an actress who was more bankable, more of a name, when the play went to Broadway. Then I had a real nervous breakdown and ended up in the ER. After that, I had a giant and delicious slice of pizza with fried eggplant and mushrooms a few blocks from Beth Israel at 3 a.m. and walked home with my friends Jen Ruff and Michael Paines. I had a wonderfully deep sleep from the Xanax. After a few days with the curtains drawn, I'd somewhat accepted that the rules had changed and that things weren't going to go my way. I even accepted my nervous breakdown as something I needed to go through and come out of. I got my curiosity and dignity back, enough to go out and hobnob. Ironically, I did that at the premiere party for the second season of Girls. Judd Apatow was there, in the distance, with no appetite for me. I saw a friend involved with that play that had sent me over the edge, someone who'd stayed at my house before. So I asked about the play, naturally. What happened? I said. What went down? And he said, do you want to talk about it here? And I said, sure, why not? Then someone pulled my focus for a second. The party was huge. And when I turned around, he had disappeared. Being real in showbiz gets you nowhere, kid. I met a really adorable Canadian fellow, around your age, a manager, with hopes of becoming a producer. He confided in me a recent epiphany. I lie a little bit, all day long, over and over again. He was dazed by the revelation and shook his head, perplexed. I lie to people. On the phone. All day. That's my work. I lie. He knew the truth of what was ahead and was not going to quit. Yeah, showbiz can be dark. I did a little indie movie with Demi Moore and vividly remember her saying, "Sometimes you gotta pay the devil." She was walking backward and shrugging with swagger like a star in a Western film, her hotel keycard in her hand, ready to open the door. We played Celebrity at her house that year with other celebrities like Ashton Kutcher and Bruce Willis. I didn't play because I don't like games, but I love watching people play them. After that breakdown, I called my reps, asking if they could look into pitching me as a weather girl on the Today Show. They thought that was funny, but I thought it was a good idea. Weather is something you can count on, whether the weather's inside or whether the weather is outside. That turban suits you. 2. How I got my name. I was born fighting for my life. That's how the story begins, or the ones my parents tell me, which they perform really well, too. I stopped breathing at a certain point, and my dad, who was kneeling outside the ICU window, said, "Please, God, let my baby girl live. Please, please, please." He had a six-pack of Budweiser beside him, and as he drank the beer, it occurred to him, my daughter is the size of this beer can. She's a beer can on legs. When he tells it, he mimes holding a beer can and mimics my legs sticking out of it, and we laugh. He was in his army gear in the hospital. He was stationed in Baltimore, and he put down the can and returned to his intense prank. "Please, please, please, Lord," he said, his hands clasped. "Let my little baby girl live." I then let out a scream, as if on cue. The story, told to me my whole life at every birthday, helped me imagine that my dad could get God on the phone whenever he wanted, that if my dad prayed hard enough, God would pick up his very important telephone and take Dad's call. Since I grew up Catholic, I imagined the saints and angels as holy secretaries clamoring to get to God specifically for my dad, despite all the other work they had to do. There was Saint Christopher, who carried Jesus as a baby without knowing who he was yet and was made the patron saint of travel because he was just nice. He had to help everyone traveling, yet he could answer my dad's call to God the very moment I was born. There was St. Anthony helping people find their lost keys, and he too would drop his responsibilities in order to get the phone to God because I was being born and my dad had persuasive powers. My mom had gone in for a checkup at the hospital on Halloween. The story goes that the doctor felt around in her uterus and shook his head in disbelief. Then he went to get the nurse who came in and felt around, and she and the doctor started laughing. My mother in stirrups was left out of the joke. Then the doctor told her she was having twins, which was a real trick-or-treat moment. I was born a week later on November 8, 1968 at 3:33 a.m., despite a due date of January 7, 1969. My mom was just 22, a baby herself, and describes this time as being completely overwhelming. I can imagine. "Excuse me, can I have a Diet Coke?" "Thank you." My twin brother, Chris, was closer to the door on the way out. Hanging out in utero together would be the closest we'd be in our lives, and the act of being born was, of course, our first trauma. I later learned that my mother had been in utero with the twin too, but that she'd lost her brother. My brother was first and jaundiced, weighing 5 pounds. I came out 3 minutes later. We were both breech and pulled out by our feet, and my mom was fully sober for all this. "Can you imagine?" She says, "I swear I felt you come out from under my arm." Maybe next year for Halloween I'll make a big hat that looks like an arm and just come as myself. No, I think a can of Budweiser would be too obvious. One of my first memories, whether or not it's real, is of my brother being wheeled away from me on a gurney. The image is black around the edges and blurry, and I'm not sure if I created this moving shot or if it happened. After he was taken away, the doctor came into my mother's room and said, "Your little boy is fine, but your girl, we need a name for the death certificate." Hearing this story as a child made me feel as if I'd already made it, having gotten through being born. It was like applause. So my name. When my mom was 11, she was a Girl Scout, and her friend's older sister had a daughter named Parker. Back then, my mom thought to herself, if I ever have a little girl, I will give her a strong name like Parker. Her own name was Linda, spelled with a Y. She always hated it. The obligatory Y, my mom called it. Why? 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 So when the doctor asked for a name, my mom said Parker for my first name and Christian for my middle name, because they wanted the help of Jesus and of the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Posey was from my father, obviously. My mother says she thought the name Posey was silly, and it really is. I know. My name sounds made up. I will most definitely make that arm hat for Halloween next year and come as myself. I was just 2.5 pounds and spent 6 weeks in intensive care, and the nurse's hands, enclosed in rubber gloves, held me inside the incubator. The first photograph I have of myself is of the moment I was brought home from the hospital. I'm in my mother's lap, wearing fake eyelashes. When I asked my mom why she put fake eyelashes on me, she said, "You were so small, I didn't know what to do with you." She also said, "You were born a nervous wreck." She'd see me in the hospital being fed by an eyedropper, like they do with baby birds. And I must have looked unreal to her. I look at home in these eyelashes, though, huh? Later on in my 20s, after a stint of playing too many roles in too short a time, the birth and death of those characters triggered my birth trauma. I crawled on the floor to my psychoanalyst, Mildred Newman, and sat at her feet and cried the trauma through me. Nora Ephron was a former patient of Mildred's and described her as a white witch. But to me, she resembled my granny in an old-world European way. Mildred helped me through a lot, especially when I became more known and tried to isolate myself from my success as if it were a catastrophe. Being famous is a birth into something else, and some people can handle it better than others. The diagnosis was simple to Mildred. If my good wishes came true, then my bad wishes could come true as well. My psyche was frozen in that battle. At her feet, I was in a trance, and she said, "Those nurses held you and looked at you with love and care through a glass box. Now look at what you do." I felt her spell, and my eyes started to crack. When Dad left the Army base in Baltimore for Vietnam, Mom drove us down to Shreveport, Louisiana, in a red convertible Fiat. It was still winter, but we were kept warm on the floor in the back seat, close to the engine, where the humming vibration soothed us, and where I developed a preternatural sense of smell for gasoline, which I've always loved. We'd stay with my grandparents, Nani, whose real name was Faye, and Glenn Patton, in their ranch-style house on Lover's Lane, where tensions were rife and fraught, but disguised and kept separate in that southern way, left behind closed doors and swept under the rug. My parents had eloped for a shotgun wedding and had no real home together quite yet, and Dad got drafted in a war that hippies were protesting and most people, including my mom, were questioning. To this day, she still says, "Why were we over there?" Like a wife and mother. She became a student teacher in Monroe, Louisiana, and taught junior high. She lived in an apartment and made friends with her neighbors, Pat and Duddy Garrett. This lasted for 3 years with us back and forth to Baltimore when Dad had breaks from the war. He was a captain liaison officer. Chris and I said Dada for the first time into a reel-to-reel tape recorder that my mom mailed him. We listened to his voice and she would point to the tape recorder saying, "That's Dada." Once when he came back for a quick trip to the base in Baltimore, my dad saw us screaming bloody murder and holding tight to our mother's legs. He called back to the stewardess at the top of the stairs and said, "I have an easier duty back in Nam." We didn't recognize him because he wasn't a tape recorder, and the noise of the plane was fierce in our ears. But when he got close to us on the tarmac, my mom pointed and said, "Dada." And then we started the Dada bit, which had become a song at this point. And Dad sang along and swept us up, carrying us to the car. Nani knew a neighborhood girl named Missy, who was 6 years old and blonde with pigtails, and whose mother was a flight attendant. One day, Missy was walking alone in the neighborhood and knocked on Nani's door, asking for candy. Nani loved the gall of this girl, but told her, "You'd better go ask your mother if it's all right." It's not safe to knock on the doors of people's houses you don't know, so go on and ask your mom if it's all right, and then I'll give you some candy. The girl went away, and Nani watched her through her kitchen window as Missy stood at the end of the driveway for several minutes, alone, and tapping her feet and swaying to pass the time. Then she watched as she walked back up the driveway and knocked on the door again. When Nani opened the door the second time, Missy said that her mom said it was okay to have candy. She had some nerve and was a good little actress. Nani loved this story so much that she called me Missy in tribute. But I felt something was amiss in my not being older and blonder and not having hair long enough for pigtails. So I daydream about being someone else. When I was 9, I told Nani that I was going to be a movie star, and she told me that she was going to be the president of the United States. Guess I won. 3. Why are you an actor? I'm an actor because funny things happen to me and shame flirts with me. I left my apartment once and I didn't tie my harem pants tight enough around the waist, so they dropped to my ankles while I was walking down Fifth Avenue. I found a stranger to help my shame and wanted to share a laugh. This lady was an older woman in her 80s with great style, big glasses, sharp quilted blazer, and I smiled and turned my inner camera on so I could remove myself from the situation. I said, "My pants fell down," almost like, "Hi, how's it going?" She didn't respond or laugh because she wasn't an audience member in my show. She grimaced, maybe thinking I was a streaker, and walked quickly past. So I said it again, to absolutely no one, but to the air around me and to the buildings as I pulled my pants back up and tied them back together. When I'm asked what's it like being an actress, I always say it's like walking around with your pants down and around your ankles. It's somewhat of a stock answer, so I was happy to experience it for real. Embarrassing and shamefully uncanny things that are at first humiliating and only funny later seem to naturally happen to me. I think this is a big part of why someone becomes an actor. In my Chelsea days in the 90s, I'd start baths and forget about them, flooding the beauty shop downstairs. But Kathleen, the owner, was laid back and cool. "It's the third time in a month I flooded the beauty shop downstairs. I forgot about it. How could this happen again?" It's like forgetting is something that happens to you and not something that you participate in or that you're like, you know, responsible for creating. You're stressed out and your friend calls and says, "What are you up to?" And you say, "I'm looking for my phone." You look for your glasses for 10 minutes while they're on your head or you're wearing them. I've slipped on banana peels several times in my life, and not as a joke. The door is open when I'm in the bathroom many times because I haven't locked it, and the other person is more embarrassed about it than I am. I'll never understand how I could watch my hand casually toss my Nokia Nugget into the gutter and into a puddle as I strode down the sidewalk. It felt like something out of the Matrix. This was made more absurd and uncanny in that it was the first of 3 times that I lost my phone that week. The second of those times, losing it just meant leaving my phone somewhere because I didn't want to be reached. But the third time, I was in Madison Square Garden with my 8-year-old niece, Isabella, for the Cirque du Soleil Christmas show. Have you been to the theater there? It's huge, just wow. It holds around 5,000 people. Our seats were close to the stage, down in E or F for the first level, right in the center front. We arrived at the perfect time for the theater, with less than 10 minutes to wait, enough time to get some water, enough time to maintain our excitement and focus for the magical show, and enough time for me to wink at those who recognize me and wait for the curtain to rise. It was then that I realized that my phone was missing. It felt like some bad joke. "Bella, where's my phone?" I said. She said, "Didn't you just buy one on the way up here?" I had indeed, in Chelsea, when I hopped in a cab to swing by to get her. So we're digging through my bag and looking under the seats, and the people in front of us and behind us are looking as well. I'm patting my pockets and shaking our coats. "This is the third time I've lost my phone this week," I share with strangers around me. They're laughing, of course. Bella says I must have placed it on the bar when we got our water. I ask the kind strangers if they could watch my niece for a second, and I scamper, all hunched and hiding, as I run to one of the theater ushers. She points me to the security guard down and up front, standing at the lip of the stage. "I've lost my phone," I tell the security guard, exasperated. The guard points me toward the lobby, up the long flight of stairs. Should I stay or should I go? It was daunting. I would have to run. The lights are dimming, on and off, the intro music has started, and I'm out of the gate, hauling up those stairs, two at a time. Panting, I ask the bartender if I left my phone there, and he says no, but I can check the office at intermission. "Okay, good plan," I blurt out and start my hunched and speedy jaunt again, down the steps where the lights have dimmed, but the theater's not yet completely dark. There's a spotlight on the performer playing a burglar elf dressed in green spandex. He's dancing around, introducing the show in Cirque du Soleil fashion, animated like a court jester. He warns the audience of a pickpocket and instructs everyone to hold on to their purses and wallets. I'm breathless and shaking my head like a crazy lady as the spotlight catches me mid-gate and I freeze. 5,000 people laughing. The joke's on me as I run back up the steps to a security guard holding my phone out to me. Caught. Things like that, that just happen, are the reason I'm an actor. David Harbour, who plays the cop in Stranger Things, I ran into him a couple of years ago, walking with a crutch and a full leg cast. I was eating my pretzel croissant from City Bakery, and he was going inside for a cookie. I asked what happened, and he told me he had to back out of a production of Troilus and Cressida at Shakespeare in the Park, where he was to play Achilles, because he tore his Achilles heel. Sometimes you're in the play, but not the play you'd intended. And that's what's strange with a career in acting. My mom was always burning herself in the oven. She said it was hereditary and that her father was always burning himself in the oven too. "Is Glenn going to have a Band-Aid on?" we'd ask on the way to visit my grandparents, and when he did, we'd all laugh. In the house were lots of Band-Aids, peroxide, Neosporin, and back then, mercurochrome and methylate, which we called monkey blood because it stained red. You'd blow on it if it was methylate because it burned like hell, and you'd beg mom to use mercurochrome because it didn't burn. All of us over the age of 30 have mercury in our blood. They later learned it was poisonous to the brain, which is too bad because the stuff worked. Needles and thread at the ready for mending, and baking soda for stains. I liked the grunge period in the 90s when Gen Xers wore ripped clothes with safety pins and tied flannel shirts at the waist. Shirts that looked like hand-me-downs from your older brother, with missing buttons, left unmended. When I was a little girl, I had a rag doll that got so dirty and worn from all my playing that she'd get thrown in the washer and dryer repeatedly. She was 100% cotton. When her blue felt eyes came off, my mom sewed new ones back on with black thread, making her eyes solid pupils. I called her Muffin. There's a nod to her in my Waiting for Guffman monologue in the deleted scenes. And she had yellow yarn hair that was in a permanent upswirl from my hand holding tightly under her head. I have a series of photos of Muffin and me, with my mom and my dad and my brother from when we were five. We look picture perfect, although the day had started badly with me running away from the camera lens. I liked to say back then, "Don't look at me, don't touch me," when someone wanted to take my picture. I'd even splay my hand in front of my face and grunt as I said it. It was primal for me, but for others it was funny. I know, look at me now. The photographer didn't scare me, but the camera did. I think it has something to do with how my parents changed when the camera pointed at them, and that I didn't know my part in the scene. But also, I loved Muffin and wasn't sure that my parents would want her in the picture because she had weird hair and looked poor, dirty. But the photographer liked her, so eventually he led me and Muffin to a flower bush to smell the flowers. My mood shifted as I found myself in the scene everyone wanted me to be in, and I was comfortable in the frame of the shot. I wore Muffin out so much that I got another one for Christmas. She'd lose her eyes again and get new ones sewn back on. big black pupils again, like the lens of a camera. 4. Nani's Fireball. There was no way Nani was going to be called Grandma or Meemaw because names like that sounded old. She wanted to be called Nani, a name that no other grandmother I knew had. It's abbreviated from the Italian Nona, which has a ring to it and sounds lyrical, lofty, and traveled. Her real name, Faye, means fairy, and she was very much otherworldly and wholeheartedly self-created. Nani's mother, Sarah Josephine Eskridge, was one of 9 girls, all of whom went to college and did cotillion and all that chic stuff women did back then. But Sarah Josephine Eskridge married beneath her, a cowboy, a ranch hand named Jesse Thomas Baggett. Jesse did the rodeos, which was badass and cool, but the Eskridges couldn't stand him. Not that he gave a shit. No, this wasn't in Italy. It was in Wichita Falls, Texas. I wish I could say that Jesse loved Sarah Jo because it would have set a good example, but according to my mom, they had 2 modes of communicating, pretending the other didn't exist, which is different from ignoring someone, although they did that too, and fighting. And Jesse doesn't sound like much of a conversationalist, since sometimes he didn't even bother to sit down to eat with his family, opting instead to pull a chair up to the fridge and eat from there. They slept with a sheet partition between them, which isn't usually a sign of getting along. Sarah Jo chased Jesse around with a skillet, apparently, and a knife at one point, threatening to kill him. I hear she was a warm and loving grandmother, but favored boys like everyone back then. Mom describes the dynamic between the couple as a showdown, and Jesse as Texas tough. When my mother was 5 years old, her family lived in Texas. This was before the move to Louisiana, and she remembers Jesse eating breakfast, 3 fried eggs with molasses on top. He stirred it all with a stick of butter, which he took a bite out of like a piece of toast. They had their own cows and a dairy farm, so he could do with his butter what he damn well pleased. Thank God they had that farm to sell eggs and milk during the Dust Bowl days, when the sky turned black and dusted the very air they breathed, and during the Great Depression of the 30s, which decimated agriculture and left people starved and homeless. The weather alone was brutal and relentless year-round. It would get so hot in the summers that you could fry an egg on the sidewalk. As the radio DJ did just that, describing it animatedly and with humor, my mom would roll her eyes and think, "That's supposed to make us feel better?" When Jesse barreled through the living room, outfitted in his cowboy gear, the gun, the holster, the whole 9, shouting, "Let's corral! Let's corral!" my mom and her 2 brothers, Tim and Jimmy, would spring off the floor. My mom remembers making eye contact with her brothers and her dad, all of them rolling their eyes at the ruckus, and what a show of machismo Jesse made of it. That bit of extra that wild people take over the room with. Glenn Patton was my mother's father and courted Nani when she was just 17. They met at a government-sponsored dance social in Amarillo, not too far from Wichita Falls. He was Irish and Scottish and was the 7th son of the 7th son. The religious connotations of this being something that gave him special powers didn't go to his head at all. It was by default, in actuality, since one brother died of tuberculosis and the other childbirth, but that still counted, right? I loved it when that conversation started. Nani would gloat when she'd talk about it, saying, "Yes, it did mean something, and it did count." We'd look at Glenn like he had special powers, and he would laugh and shake his head, good-natured and reading his paper with a Benson and Hedges cigarette burning in his ashtray. He had a great sense of humor and humored Nani in her fantasy life. He had to. Their courtship is upstaged by Nani's older sister, Lois's husband, though. His name was Albert Higgins. Lois was also just 17 when she and Albert dated for a bit and then married. He moved into the house when Nani was 14 and she hated him. He was even wilder, more primitive than her own father. Anyway, on one of Nani and Glenn's early dates, Glenn walked my grandmother up the driveway where Albert was hiding in a tree. When they passed under him, he farted on them and laughed like the crazy man he was. Nani hated his guts, and for good reason. I'm sure he tried to chase her down. Glenn was a pilot and took her away from all that. He taught at the flight school in Amarillo, and his father had been mayor of Amarillo in the early 1900s because he was the WEC candidate. Translation, he was for booze and had his own saloon. His name was J.H. Patton, and he saw the first pavement laid on Polk Street. J.H. was charming and fun, liked to socialize in the public square, and kept candy in his pockets to give to the kids. The saloon was called the Old Forester, where you'd pay with cash in exchange for wooden coins you'd keep tight in your suit pocket for drinks and maybe even a glass flask of whiskey. Those coins are collector's items now. My cousin Todd was on a website and saw an old bottle of whiskey and some bar tokens with her great-grandfather's name on them, but the guy who ran the site wouldn't sell Todd the coins or that old bottle. Maybe he held a family grudge and would take the memorabilia to his grave, along with some rifles. Yep, don't mess with Texas. Nani and Glenn settled for a bit in Amarillo and had children. My Uncle Tim was first. As a kid, he remembers Uncle Albert perching outside on the air conditioner in only his underwear, holding a gun. The family was having dinner, and a prisoner had been released from Leavenworth Prison, which was about 6 hours away, so Albert was on the lookout. One time, probably to entertain my Uncle Tim, or maybe it was some ritual since Albert was a Mason, he stood on the kitchen table, unscrewed the light bulb from the fixture, and stuck his finger in the socket to make his hair stand on end. He learned that from the carnival, where he met my great-aunt Lois. She was blonde and beautiful, and at Albert's funeral, she had a broken arm. It was a funeral Nani was happy to attend. When I was little, Nani was, for me, a queen. Tall and thin, with dark hair, a raven beauty. She dressed like a movie star and would go to Neiman Marcus for inspiration and return home to sew her own clothes. She had a movie star way of talking, too, and of comporting herself. When she'd say, "I'm just a country girl," she sounded and acted just like Susan Hayward. Not like a country girl at all. She'd sashay around in high-heeled boots, swaying her hips in pencil skirts, with nowhere to go except lunch at the Piccadilly or bingo at the Petroleum Club, which served a delicious buffet dinner. The names of both places reeked of high class to me. And truly, even though the Piccadilly was just a cafeteria, it was a big deal to go there. Glenn would put the copper-colored coffee thermos on the table, and Nani'd say, "Who will do the honors?" and gesture to the thermos like it was Waterford crystal. At night, Nani added sweet and low to her Zinfandel wine, tapping the pink packet into her glass like it was gold dust. And she'd say, emphatically and with feeling, "I can't stand the bitterness." She always said it with profundity, as if it were the first time she'd realized this. I'd give her a new reaction each time, as if the cameras were rolling. Each take better than the last. She prefaced the most mundane comments with phrases like, "Forgive me if I may say so," and then would go on to say something that wasn't anything she'd need forgiveness for, which muddled my Catholic brain. She let me stay up late with her to watch talk shows and old movies, and we'd sponge roll our hair, pin curl it, and do our nails. In the morning, I sat on the couch with the Yorkies, Benji and Teddy, their framed photographs blending into the wood-paneled walls. We'd brush our hair out, and she'd lament, "Why, I could have been a textile designer in New York. Mm-hmm, I really could have." I would zone out, staring at the dirty feet of the boys in a reproduction print by the Baroque painter Murillo, which was the only other picture on the wall in the TV room. "Why, if I could do it all over again, Mittens, I would have married a man who'd have given me gifts. Someone who'd take me out to places." I'd spin her globe, close my eyes, and stop it with my finger. Then take it to Nani, and she'd tell me where I ended up. Glenn would be at work during the day, at Sunbeam Bread. Nani sat in her rich leather chair in front of the built-in bookshelf, which mostly held the Encyclopedia Britannica. There were other things to look at on those shelves that I liked. A tiny figurine of Ganesh, who, when I asked about him, she'd say, "I don't believe in him, Mittens. I just like the aesthetics." She had regular playing cards that I got to use, and a double deck of cards encased in French provincial-style covered compacts, which she used for bridge. There was a Buddha and a sumo wrestler and a geisha woman and her fan, harmoniously placed. I liked looking at her book about Ikebana floral arrangements. She'd say things like, "I love the Orient," as if she'd visited there, seen all the sights, and had a fabulous time. She would sort through the paper, cutting coupons, and say things to the newspaper as if people lived in there. "Serves you right," she'd say with her quiet, genteel judgment. Yes, serves you right. When I finished fixing myself, I'd put the pins or rollers away and move from the couch to the floor and do back bends or splits and watch TV. I'd watch Nani watching the TV, and I'd see how content she became as she placed herself inside it. She was happy and humming, swinging her cross leg or shimmying her shoulders to the music. She threw her head back and laughed, watching Gwen Burden or Liza Minnelli, and she adored Bob Fosse. "Mittens, why do you think homosexuals make the best choreographers?" she'd ask. Bob Fosse wasn't a homosexual, but she probably thought he was. I was around 8 years old, so I didn't really know what she was talking about. I got to meet Liza on a film I did called The O in Ohio, and I told her how much Johnny giggled at the sexuality of Fosse's choreography, and Liza said that she'd made him laugh. "I didn't even know what I was doing was sexy, but he'd sit in the audience just laughing at me." By the way, Liza needlepoints on set in what she calls jazz or freeform style. Nani and I play cards in our time together, too. She taught me how to play solitaire, a game she loved, as she was always happily self-absorbed. She enjoyed having conversations with herself, her interior life so loaded that snippets of dialogue would naturally come out. I loved it when she sang as she got dolled up, whether or not she had anywhere to go. She let me be, and I enjoyed that, playing with the plastic buttons in her sewing box, respectful of the nice scissors, the ones to cut fabric, not paper. I hummed along with her as she waltzed around through the kitchen and into the bathroom where the good towels were folded perfectly in the cabinet and never used. I'd open the cabinet and stare at those towels like they were King Tut's tomb. There was a soap dish in clear plastic wrap with decoupage flowers, never opened, never touched. Then I'd look at myself in the mirror. My hair, brushed out and curly, looked like a wig. It reminded me of Judy Garland and her movies on TV. King Tut. He could have won a Grammy. King Tut, buried in his jammies. At my brother's wedding, Nani danced the night away and took breaths to alternately puff on a cigarette or her asthma inhaler. She was in her early 80s and still living it up. She kicked through the Charleston and said repeatedly, "I could dance forever. I just love dancing." Since Glenn had passed away, she'd been partying it up with the Greeks at the Orthodox Church in Shreveport, and they loved to dance, apparently, so she had a fun group of friends. "I love the Greeks," she'd say, with the certainty and fervor of a politician. I'd picture her friends looking like Greek statues. What Nani didn't love was her son-in-law. My dad didn't kowtow to her or treat her like a queen. She didn't find him charming or funny, which drove him to act even more provocative and obnoxious. She'd met her match in him. They both ruled any room they entered, but my father, with his sense of humor, could bring any house down, including and especially hers. They needled each other with mind games worthy of the theater. It was not boring, but it was not peaceful. When the air was tense and drama was being whipped up, when the family spoke their resentments toward each other in silence, and when the drinks got made, I liked to sit on the floor in the kitchen and spin the double-tiered Lazy Susan that held the canned goods. Green beans, asparagus, deviled ham, which came wrapped in white paper, little red devil modeling with a pitchfork. The miniature Morton Salt with the girl on the label. She was my age and had a pageboy haircut and a yellow raincoat. Her umbrella produced the rain under her parasol, and she was happy on her walk. I'd spin that lazy Susan again and again, grabbing the cans and stacking them before they whipped away and back around. It was a game between heaven and hell, the can of deviled ham against the Morton Salt girl. She raises her umbrella and shoots the rain that drowns the devil back to hell. Nani made recipes straight out of Good Housekeeping magazine. She'd make brisket or marinated crab claws, pimento cheese, and artichoke dip, and she served canned asparagus as if they were fresh. She exuded such intense imperiousness over everything that my Uncle Tim didn't know she hadn't invented the BLT until he went to college. She also adored atomic fireballs, those bright red jawbreaker candies, which she kept in a big white box on the island in the kitchen. My cousin Samantha and I would climb on the table to get to them when Nani wasn't looking and run them underwater to let the heat out. We stared at the only picture hanging in the kitchen, a somber old man praying to a loaf of bread. When we asked who the man was, Nani said it was God. We asked questions about that, like, how can someone take a picture of God? And Nani would leave the room, which made us laugh. I took catechism, so I knew God made everything and knew everything and was in everything. It was inane to think that this man was God, because why would he choose to be photographed praying to a sad loaf of bread? And why look so glum? Jesus, it didn't make sense. One Thanksgiving on Lover's Lane, after we'd eaten and were sitting around in that post-turkey dip, my dad had this ingenious idea and put down his drink and went into the fridge. He snagged the innards of the turkey from the crisper and cupped them in his hands. Then he went up to Nani and said, "Nani, the meal was delicious, but cough, cough, I don't feel so good." He pretended to throw up and coughed some more and showed her his bloody hands holding the turkey remnants entrails. If she thought this was funny, she sure as hell didn't show it, and I doubt she thought it was funny. She put herself above laughs that she didn't orchestrate herself. It was a Texan showdown stare-down, to be sure, and my dad won. Nani was on a mad for that number, stoic and beautiful in her resentments as she conversed with herself, holding tight and chewing all that bitter material. The following day, when we were in the kitchen eating leftovers, my father started cutting the turkey, and it started rolling back and forth. He put down the knife and picked up the turkey, and there it was. Nani's fireball. It was smaller and not as bright red as it was before, but still mobile enough to hold and rock a carcass with a knife. How the fireball got there is still a mystery. In tribute to Nani, as well as to the Patton side of my family, I'd like to turn you on to the fireball cocktail. You can call it the Nani if you'd like. It's inspired by the Manhattan cocktail, like my Aunt Peggy likes, but has a fireball thrown into the mix. When the fireball releases its potency, it sweetens the drink and turns it red. A few dashes of bitters are balanced out by the pure sweetness of sugar. The drink takes beautiful shape, like a cosmos. Fireball cocktail, also known as the Nani. 1.5 ounces Rittenhouse rye. 3/4 ounce Puntemesse vermouth. 2 dashes of Miss Better's Batch 42 aromatic bitters. 1 atomic fireball candy. Lemon peel expressed. Place ingredients over ice in glass and stir. Pour in shaker and shake. Dance, please. Express the lemon peel's oil over the finished cocktail and drink. Then express yourself and get loose. Cheers to our lineage and being able to live on the planet at this time. And don't forget that resentment is poison. And good luck with your regrets. They'll leave you lonely, and you can't dance with them. 5. Pansies are for thought. I spent time at my other grandmother's too. Granny's name was Nadis de Latin, and she lived in Shreveport as well. She was the landlady in one of those old southern homes in the corner of the street. It was 3 stories and had a huge wraparound porch. Off to the side, where the traffic whizzed by, was a bench swing, maybe